Hi, I'm Jordan, and you found another episode of On Mic with Jordan Rich, the podcast that celebrates conversation with creative people who have a lot to say and a lot to offer. Always great to welcome back my friend Lon Davis, known as the champion of the silent cinema and a movieholic just like me. Len is an author, editor, documentarian, and lecturer on film history. He's written several other books that we've talked about in the past. His latest is called Stumbling into Film History, a story of a young Lon Davis, a teenager in the early 1970s, who's lucky enough to know and befriend some of the greats of the silent screen. Let's talk with him about it right now as we welcome Lon Davis to join us once again on Mic. Stumbling into film history, Lon Davis, how did the stumble start? How did it all begin?
It began when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My father was a professional photographer, and he would spend hours and hours in camera stores. And he unfortunately always took me along with him. And I was bored out of my mind. And I think just to keep me quiet, he pointed out some 8mm films, the 50-foot reels, those little bitty things. They were selling for $1 each, and they were little clips of Chaplin, Laurel and Hardy, and various of the silent film comedians and cartoons from the silent era. And I was transfixed. I had never seen anything like it, but it spoke to me very, very loudly. And I'm sure I begged and pleaded and ended up him forking over a few bucks to get a few reels. And we had an 8mm projector at home, and he ran those for me and for the family, showing them on the refrigerator door, I remember. And they were these lousy little, essentially dupe prints of these old films. They looked terrible, but I didn't care. They to me were, it was like a window to a brand new world.
Isn't that interesting that, you know, a lot of young people, even then, prior to the video age, would not even find it interesting if there's no sound, and yet you were fascinated by it, sort of meant to be, I think, in your life.
Yes. Well, quite frankly, being a kid in the 60s, you made do with less than kids certainly do today. They wouldn't have the patience to watch old silent, you know, pictures in that way. Everything's at the, you know, press of a button at the, it's on your phone, it's everywhere, you can see everything in HD and whatever. And it was different. I mean, it was a little bit like growing up in the Depression or something, you know, because entertainment was so primitive in a lot of ways then. And fortunately, they ran a lot of silent comedies on television, and I watched those, and everything I did just seemed to reinforce more and more my growing passion for silent films.
Well, the neat thing, too, is back in the 20s and 30s, that was the height of technology, so it's not like comparing apples and oranges. It was a great time to be alive if you dug that kind of thing. But I love the fact that you were at the right place at the right time to catch the very tail end of the stars, right, Lon? I mean, we'll talk about
some of them specifically,
but really, I mean, they were dying off at a pretty quick rate at that point.
Oh, they certainly were. In fact, most people were already gone, you know, even that far back in the early 60s. But there are those, particularly women, who hang on into their 80s or whatever, even 90s. And so I was able to meet several people like that. And of course, some individuals I knew from a later era, and they would have been like in their 60s or 70s, which was far more workable, if you know what I'm saying.
We've talked in the past about you connecting and befriending the great Larry Fine of the Three Stooges at the old actor's home. That was a place where you met others, not just Larry, and you talk about him in this book as well.
Yes, I did. Larry was retired, of course. He had had a stroke. He was 71 years old when I met him, and sadly he died when he was only 72. But in that year that I knew him, he and I were in constant communication. So I really got to know him quite well. And I also saw his decline and his depression, and I did everything I could to help cheer him up. I would even sometimes send him cartoons that I would draw of him, you know, or the Stooges or something. And he would show those around to the other patients there, like a great, like a proud grandfather would. Mm. I thought that was so sweet.
And for a young kid at the time, a young teenager, that was, well, let's put it this way. Like me, I think you're an old soul. I think even then, you know.
Well, yeah, definitely.
Connected with these people.
Yeah, sure. I was not in any way a typical kid. And I did, I felt very comfortable around seniors. This started back in the early days for me. I went to a Catholic school in upstate New York, and the nuns recognized the fact that I had some ability to do voices and tell jokes and whatnot. And they would take me to various nursing homes, which in those days were basically just wards, you know, with a lot of beds and stuff. And I would go from bed to bed doing my act, you might say. And I would see the light in these people's eyes, and it inspired me. I realized they had a lot to say, and we enjoyed communicating, and I just felt a special kinship with them.
There are some great stories in the book by Lon called Stumbling Into Film History, and many of them feature individual characters, actors who had stardom 50, 60, 70 years prior. And I want to start with some of the actresses who were babies, literally toddlers, and then blossomed into big stars, and they were very much forgotten by so many people. For instance, Baby Peggy and Zoe Ray. These were older ladies when you met them, but they were big stars when they were just little tykes.
Absolutely. And they were two delightful, delightful, wonderful ladies. Baby Peggy was an enormous star in the 20s. She was, she in terms of box office, she was up with the biggest stars in the firmament at that time. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but it started because Charlie Chaplin did the film The Kid with Jackie Coogan. And Jackie Coogan was this charismatic, adorable little boy. And people so fell in love with him that it started off the trend toward toddlers or young children in films as stars. And Baby Peggy, Peggy Montgomery was her original name, she basically was able to ride on the on that particular trend. Her parents micromanaged her terribly, and she did become a big star for a couple of years. And then just as quickly, she was out of the business. And that is so true for many child actors, obviously.
It's interesting, too, how much product they pushed out in those days. I mean, we're not talking about epic blockbuster films that ran 2 hours. They were short, but the studios were cranking these things out in
They really were. And I don't know why they did so many, but it seems like a lot of studios, like you take the Keystone Studio, headed by Max Sennett, and they... their policy was to put out one reel a week. And whereas that doesn't sound like much, considering that a film was like 12 minutes long, they would film them entirely in one day. And post-production was minimal. And then they would send these films out, and films were constantly changing at the box office. It was impossible to see the same film twice, unless it was something like The Great Train Robbery, which was a huge landmark in films in 1903. But we're talking in the teens and 20s, and they made indeed hundreds of these short films every year, and people got to know them. This is even before the star system was established, and people became curious about who these people were. Producers did not want to give their names because they thought as soon as they become popular, they will demand more money. Mm. Well, if they could have seen today's salaries that actors are paid in films, they would have had a fit, I think, because they basically, the star system took over Hollywood, and it was no longer so much a director's medium as it became an actor's medium.
Lon, you mentioned Hollywood. Were these films at that very early juncture also produced on the East Coast?
They were. The East Coast was where it really started in the United States. Back in New Jersey, they had was among the first studios, including Thomas Edison's studio, the Black Maria. And of course, in New York, they had various companies. Chicago was the real place of the movies, you might say the movies progression in the 1910s. And they made thousands of films. Unfortunately, when the 30s came and sound was in the picture, these films were regarded as so much refuse. And people would think, I don't want to pay to store these old films, which have no commercial value. And so they were burned or destroyed in some other way. It was incredible, the loss and the waste of an entire art form.
You and your wife, Deb, have done a lot of work to keep these memories alive in books and in documentaries. One documentary about an old star, Francis X. Bushman. Love that name. And yes, you wrote a book about him. But in this new version of your memories, which is called Stumbling Into Film History, you write about the woman Beverly Bain, and she ended up being married to Francis Bushman. Why did you lead with her? She's a very important figure way back when, isn't she?
She was. She was a major, major star in the teens, starting in 1912 and up to the end of that decade, and also and later, a very noted actress on the Broadway stage. She was, the reason I led with Beverly is because she was the very first silent film actress that I befriended. And I was only 13 when I first telephoned her, and we had a wonderful rapport, and I dearly loved her. We had a very, very nice relationship. And that's why I also thought her story was very tragic and it poignant. And I thought that she would be a good representation to begin the book.
Give us a sense of the poignancy, just so that we can tease the audience a little bit. What was the tragedy all
well,
about?
The tragedy was, it's two or threefold, you might say. Beverly was a young girl when she was thrust into the hemisphere or stratosphere with her stardom in 1912. And she married her leading man, Francis X. Bushman, who was already married, and he divorced his wife. And 3 days later, he married Beverly. And they had a tumultuous relationship, to hear her tell it. He was apparently, you know, impatient and egotistical. I mean, I heard every little story she ever had about him. She hated the man, hated him. Mm. The two of them had a son. Bushman had already five children when he and Beverly were married, but together they had only the one son, and he was a very handsome fellow. His name was Richard, and he grew up outside of the industry. He really had no interest in becoming an actor, even though he could have been. He looked like Tyrone Power a little bit. And when he was later in life, he lived with his mother. They both had, how can I put it? They had a relationship that just was good for Beverly, but terrible for the son. She wanted him as her companion and escort, going out to parties and whatnot. And he wanted, naturally, to pursue his own life. And he finally met a woman that he fell in love with, and Beverly did not take to it well. Because of his situation, and I can't speculate as to exactly why anyone would do this, he committed suicide. Mm. And it might easily have been other factors in his life that led him to that terrible decision. But he was a young man and he committed suicide, and Beverly never really could come to terms with that.
That's a tough thing to get over for anybody, but it points out that behind the veneer of Hollywood or the golden era or any of that stuff, these are real people with real problems, no question about it. The book is so much fun, and one of the fun things is exploring something that many people may not be familiar with, but I certainly am, the Keystone Cops. You mentioned Max Sennett. Before we talk about Eddie Levesque, who was the last surviving Keystone Cop that you were able to get to know, what were the Keystone Cops? How did they come about in the first place, and how popular were they?
Oh, the Keystone Cops are I look at them as the first comedy ensemble. Max Sennett was he was an Irishman. He was a guy from, he worked in a factory when he was young. He came from very little. He was a Canadian, and he was hopelessly stage struck. He wanted to be a star on the stage, a singer even. Well, he didn't have that kind of talent. But he had an amazing talent for cultivating great comedians. And all of the great comedians, or most of them, came out of the Max Sennett studios, and including the very most famous Charlie Chaplin. So at one point, Max Sennett had this idea that he wanted to do a satire on policemen. This is something that people really responded to, because there was so much fear among the immigrants in society of the police forces. And because of that, Sennett decided to make fun of the policemen, making them figures of like total buffoons. And audiences ate that up. It was considered quite daring at the time and cutting edge. And the Keystone Cops were a group of basically anonymous actors who would do everything wrong. I mean, their chase scenes, they never caught the bad guy they were chasing. They were just idiots. And audiences loved it. Of course, that continued forever.
It did. And you had a chance to interview and get to know Eddie Levesque, who I believe in the book is the last survivor at the time of the original troupe?
Yes. Well, that's the way he billed himself. There were actually a couple of guys who lived. There was one gentleman who lived to be 102. He had been an Olympian back in the 30s or maybe 20s. But anyway, there were a couple of others. And I knew other individuals who had been on the Keystone Cops. But Eddie Levesque was a very nice gentleman, and he is the one who made the most out of having been a Keystone Cop. He turned it into his own little franchise. After Max Sennett's death, he purchased the rights to the name Keystone Cops, and he put out, records and coloring books, and tried to start a Warner Brothers cartoon series, and he did stage shows, and I mean, he made it a whole career, and he also brought out of retirement a lot of the guys who had been in the original series, or it wasn't a series, but the original group, and gave them a second act in the 1960s. So people grew up in the 60s knowing who the Keystone Cops were and thinking, oh, they're all still around. That was quite remarkable.
So much in the book, but I have to bring up one of my favorite people and one of my favorite silent films, and I'm so glad you spent a chapter on The General, which was, of course, Buster Keaton's masterpiece. Buster Keaton, of course, lived into the 1960s, I believe. Still believe he wasn't as appreciated as he should be for the amazing film work he did, the stunt work and so forth. But why did you decide to highlight The General? What made you do that?
Well, The General has a personal connection with Deb and me. In 1984, when we got married, we were living in Northern California at the time. And we thought, let's go someplace where it's rainy and cool and everything. And we went to Oregon. We just wanted something different. Deb had been in California her whole life. She was born in San Diego.
Excuse me, I got to interject here. I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Boston. So the idea of going away from sunshine is anathema. But I understand where you're coming from, I think.
Yes. Well, like I said, I've never been a normal person. And it's kind of like the Addams Family. There's nothing like a beautiful overcast day. That's the way Deb and I perceive it. It's just there's something about it, you know, the diffused light or something. But anyhow, we moved to a place called Cottage Grove, Oregon, and Buster Keaton had made the general in Cottage Grove on location because he was able to replicate in this rural area the Civil War. And it was so authentically done, and it was such a brilliant film. That was one of the reasons we decided to move there. When I learned that the general had been shot there, I thought, that's it, we're moving here. And we did, and we lived there for 13 years. And I became very acquainted with the location, the various locations that he shot the footage there.
You look at the film today and it holds up so well, and you realize no CGI, obviously, no special effects, no film cutting. All the stunts were done live, and they were expensive and quite dangerous in that.
Oh, you're so right. And of course, that particular film has the single most expensive shot of the entire silent era. And that is when the train, which is crossing a bridge that's on fire, it collapses. And it's just this magnificent scene. And like you said, no CGI. It was absolutely real. One take only. Mm-hmm. And Buster was the type of comedian and director. He was very strict about one thing. He said, I don't want anybody calling cut unless I'm killed. And he wasn't kidding.
Yeah, that's amazing.
He was extraordinary.
Indeed he was. There's so much more in this short book that people will love if they're into movies. And even if you're not, I think it's so important for us to reflect on culture, American culture, which is film-centric. And I learned a ton about some of those early days. I mean, I'm more familiar with the 20s, you know, Nosferatu and Lon Chaney Sr. and things like that, but of course, Chaplin. But these are people I wasn't familiar with, and so their stories are interesting. Looking back, I mean, there was a tinge of regret and sadness, a little bit of that Sunset Boulevard thing going on where they seem to miss the great glory days. Did you find that to be consistent among many?
Yes, I did for the most part. Naturally, people look back to the time of their lives when they were at their most productive. And even though there are innumerable challenges to being in the public eye, and these people acknowledge that to me, they still looked back with great fondness for the most part. Some were a little bitter because of the way they were treated after having achieved stardom and then losing it. But that's natural. You know, it's nobody wants to be considered a has-been. And yet that's what if they lived long enough, that's what they became.
Yeah, it's one thing to have a long life. Everybody wants that, I guess. But at the same time, it comes with a price. if you're a fading star. Well, this is terrific. You've got all kinds of credits. I love this one as I love the previous ones. That's why you're a returning guest on many occasions. I wish you the very best. Is there a website you'd like to promote before we wrap up?
No, I don't have a website of my own, except to say that my books are all on Amazon.com, and they have done very well. This current book, I must say, has done especially well. It was listed as number one on Amazon in the historical film books category.
Oh, congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you. That was for the paperback, and then it also just this week was for the Kindle. So I'm really, really pleased that it's doing well and that people are reading it, enjoying it, and celebrating the artistry of the silent film era.
Yeah, there's so much to learn and to be thankful for, because that led to everything we know of today. I mean, we talk about Buster Keaton and that one movie. I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark, all the great movies that have followed owe a debt of gratitude to people like Buster. Well, Lon, as always, delight to see you. I'm actually looking at you for the first time in a long time. You look great.
Yeah, and, thank you.
And I wish you and Deb all the very best. And this book is definitely one that all film lovers need to check out. It's called Stumbling Into Film History by Lon Davis, L-O-N-D-A-V-I-S. My friend, thank you, and let's do more of this in the future.
Yeah, I'll do it tomorrow if you're available. Thank you, Jordan. I really appreciate you.
The book, Stumbling Into Film History, the author, Lon Davis, a terrific book for any cinema fan. Hey, thank you so much for subscribing and downloading this podcast. We appreciate all the great ratings and reviews and are growing in numbers every single solitary week. Can't thank you enough. Visit jordanrich.com or chartproductions.com to find out more. And until next time, this is JR reminding you to be well so you can do good. Take care.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.